Good morning. This is the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. President Obama, a couple of weeks ago, announced that he will be sending another 17,000 troops to Afghanistan. And the president said that the additional troops were needed to stabilize a deteriorating situation, one that has not gotten the attention and the resources that it needs. Also, the administration announced the appointment of Richard Holbrooke as special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he has said that he expects the problem of Afghanistan to be even tougher to solve than the problem of Iraq. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about what is happening today in Afghanistan, talk about the approach of the new administration. And our guest for the program is Karen von Hippel. She is the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before that, she was a senior research fellow at the Center for Defense Studies at King's College, London. She spent several years working for the UN and the EU in Somalia and Kosovo. She currently serves on the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Fragile States and has direct experience in over 24 conflict zones. She is also a contributor to a report that recently was issued by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, looking at Afghanistan and Pakistan, titled Afghanistan and Pakistan on the Brink, Framing U.S. Policy Options, was just released in February. And if you're interested, I'm sure if you go to their website, you can look at it. Questions for this program are welcome. All you need to do is call us. And if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions and comments are welcome. But the only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome. Again, 333-9455. Also toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Ms. von Hippel, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it. There is much in this report, many things that I'm interested in talking about. Mm-hmm. Perhaps just to begin with, to talk a little bit about so far what the administration has said and done. Now, one of the things that's certainly very striking in this report, you and your co-authors write that in order to succeed in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, dramatic changes are needed. I'm quoting there what it says here. Mm-hmm. Given what we now know so far about what the administration has done, more troops for Afghanistan, maybe more later, the appointment of Ambassador Holbrooke, anything else, do you think that, in fact, what the administration has done does qualify as dramatic change in U.S. policy?
Well, not really, because at the moment they've just appointed, it's fantastic, they've appointed a regional envoy, and I think Holbrooke will do a very good job. They need someone with a very strong personality. So that's been an excellent first step. And, of course, it's also good that they're doing a review of the other reviews that were initiated during the end of the Bush period. In the last 6 months, there were three or four major reviews. General Petraeus, the head of CENTCOM, did one. There was one done in the White House, another done in the Department of Defense by Admiral Mullen, who's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So there are a number of very large reviews being done on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And what Obama is now doing is trying to synthesize those earlier reviews and see how relevant they are. So at the moment, we actually don't know what the policy is going to be. All we know is that he's going to send another 17,000 troops. They haven't changed anything yet on the Pakistan side of the border, they haven't really announced what they're hoping to do in Afghanistan. The only thing they've really done, which is kind of interesting, is they've talked about narrowing down our goals, focusing more on security rather than on larger democratic reforms. So it's hard to say yet, and that's why we were saying we do believe that much more dramatic reforms are needed.
Well, that gets to what is a very, very large an important question, mm-hmm. And it goes to another one of the things that you recommend in the report, where you write about how it would be important for us to both simplify and clarify the goals here, and that invites the question, well, What are the goals? And it's not necessarily something that it seems that the various parties here that are involved, the U.S. and the United Nations and NATO, everyone doesn't really seem to be on the same page when it comes to that very question. What are the goals?
Right. That's an excellent question, and it was very interesting. We've been meeting with a number of very senior U.S. officials over the last few years, and they will say the same thing. We never really decided if we were building some sort of basic democracy or if we were really just trying to eliminate al-Qaeda. Now, I personally don't think you can eliminate al-Qaeda over the long term without building some basic rule of law and governance structures. I don't think you need Jeffersonian democracy or Valhalla, all those quotes people were using. I don't think you need to focus on establishing Switzerland, but you do need some sort of basic rule of law and governance so that the state won't revert to that which caused al-Qaeda and others to go there in the first place. So over the long term, you need to establish some sort of buffer so it won't happen again. And that's why I do think we need to couple our security reforms with basic democratic reforms as well.
And I suppose on top of that, there is the basic need for development, something that people have been talking about now for a long time, to try to do something for the country that has been damaged from so many years of fighting. We've got seriously damaged economy. We've got high levels of poverty. We have need for lots of infrastructure development. We have people there who are operating who, quite apart from the politics, are simply operating criminal enterprises. All of that while at the same time we're fighting a war.
Right.
Which makes one wonder, can really, as long as you are fighting a war, can you really hope to make very much progress on the other agenda, that is, of trying to rebuild the country?
Right. There are so many challenges, really, in Afghanistan. I mean, just to go to your previous point as well, not only does the United States need to come up with a common narrative, but also we need one that our allies can also buy into. So many of our allies are there either to make sure that NATO survives or to support the United States. They're not necessarily in it for the right reasons. And so we need to come up with a narrative that people in Canada and people in Germany and people in the United States and people in Afghanistan and Pakistan can buy into. And that could include issues such as 90% of the drugs on every street in Europe and North America come from Afghanistan. It could include issues such as what you just mentioned about how we do have a moral commitment to the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan. We've vacillated our aid. We've been very committed, and then we've withdrawn our aid, and we've done that several times over the last few decades. So we really have a moral, we owe them something to really try to help them. And then, of course, we do want over the long term to prevent it from becoming a sanctuary. So there are ways of trying to come up with a narrative that everyone can buy into. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, of course, we have problems now with the Afghan government. There are issues of corruption. There are issues of warlords in key provinces, in key ministries. The Karzai government has really retrenched. It's not trying to be to build as much as possible throughout the country, and so there a lot of Afghans have lost support in their own government, and that's a problem. In terms of what you were just talking about, trying to build schools and hospitals while we're getting shot at, that's something new. We haven't really ever done that before. We've never really tried to do development while getting shot at, or development in a place where the literacy rate is about 20%. And so there are enormous challenges that we're facing there that we haven't really faced to the degree anywhere else before.
Just to quickly introduce again, our guest is Karen von Hippel. She is a senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where she also co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project. We're talking about Afghanistan. She was one of the contributors to a recent report, Afghanistan and Pakistan on the Brink, Framing U.S. Policy Options, was released last month by the Center. And I expect if you go to their website, you can read it. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to the issue of the force strength there, as we've said, the president has said that right for the moment, initially, what he's going to do is send 17,000 more troops, and I guess there's a chance that there might be more later. So if you look at that, that would bring the total number of American troops to, I believe, to 53,000. And if you add that to all those that are there already, U.S. and others, that puts us it's a little over 100,000. Then comes the question, is that enough to do the job?
Yeah, I think actually it's a little bit less than that. I think there is a total of about 51 and 52,000 in the NATO operation, the ISAF operation, and then there's an extra 10 or 11,000 U.S. So I think we're at about 60-something, and then this extra 17,000 will bring us up to 77 or something like that. So it's a little bit lower than that. But, you know, that's sort of not as relevant. The point is that if you talk to military analysts about what they think we need to deal with such a challenging insurgency that we're facing. It's a rural-based insurgency. It's a multi-ethnic, multi-tribal. It's far more complicated terrain than we face in Iraq. And the comparable figures that we had in Iraq were, including the Iraqi security forces and the coalition forces, are about 600,000. So if you add up all the Afghan forces, police, military, with the foreign troops, you get to a much smaller figure. You get even less than 200,000. So there are many people who are arguing that we actually need to build the Afghan forces up to 2 to 3 times the current projected strength that they're focusing on right now, which is something like 130,000 for the army. And some people think we need 2 to 3 times that number.
Well, how is that clearly, as you say, and a lot of people are saying that the United States, the United Nations, NATO, can't really guarantee the long-term security and stability of Afghanistan. The Afghan people themselves have to do that,
right,
which means you're going to have a strong, well-functioning army and police force, which is something that's in that is being developed. So the question is, well, how are we doing on that? How is that maybe I shouldn't say how are we doing. How is that process going?
Right. I think the army training has been going pretty well. Afghans respect the army a lot. They're very brave. They're not afraid to fight. And I think people in general are very pleased with the progress that they've made. The issue here is, do we have enough? You know, the numbers, are they high enough, et cetera. On the police side, that's been the main problem. The police are considered very corrupt. We've been way behind in terms of really trying to build up the capacity of the police. They're corrupt, but they're also taking the brunt of the terrorist attacks. So something like 900 police have been killed in the last 2 years by the Taliban alone. So I think that's now the focus, is the police. The U.S. military has taken over the training of the police. Initially, the Germans were in charge of it. The Europeans also have a European training force called EUPOL. I don't think it's as significant as it needs to be, and I think that's why the U.S. military have gotten involved in training the police. Now, there is a big debate about, should the military be training police? The U.S. military technically isn't allowed to train the police ever since the Latin America days of the 1980s, when the U.S. military got very involved in a lot of guerrilla warfare. They wouldn't let them train police anymore. Police should be training police, but they are able to get exceptions in some circumstances, and this is one of those circumstances where, you know, we really need to ratchet up the police training. So the Army has stepped in. Now, over the long term, some people are worried that the U.S. military training is really going to focus more on building paramilitary forces rather than police forces. You know, that's really what people are worried about. You need police on the streets at the local level. And so is this the right way to do it? There's also a big discussion about rearming militias. So in addition to police and army training, rearming local militias in tribal areas. And that's quite controversial as well, because, of course, many Afghans said, we just disarmed everybody. If you're going to rearm them, how do we control them over the long term? Aren't you going to create more warlords and fiefdoms? Mm-hmm. So none of these issues have been fully decided yet. And I think hopefully many of these will be considered during these reviews that are underway.
Yeah. A number of countries have contributed resources and troops to this effort.
Mm-hmm.
The question, though, is how long will we have to? Well, how long will troops have to be in there, U.S. and otherwise? And
right,
then, what sort of commitment over the long term can you expect from some of the partners in this project? I'm thinking, for example, about the fact that now fairly recently, the government of Canada said that by 2011 they're going to be out of there.
Right.
They're pulling their troops out, and so you start wondering about, well, what about, when will a point come when other countries will say we just can't do this anymore, and we're going to pull our troops out also.
Right. So I think there are 41 contributing countries in the NATO operation, mostly NATO, but there are some that aren't in NATO that are helping out. And what's quite interesting is that only a small number of those are actually involved in the fighting. So most of them have what they're called national caveats that that restrict the type of operations and the fighting that they can be involved in. So the few countries that are fighting with us include the French, the Dutch, the Brits, the Canadians, the Australians, a small handful of countries that are fighting with us. The rest of them, the Germans, Italians, and others, have a lot of restrictions about the type of fighting that they can be involved in, because they basically thought they signed up for peacekeeping and they're losing troops, and so and it's not popular back home. The Danes are a very good example. The Danes have also been fighting, and they've lost something like 10 Danes. The Canadians have lost 100 Canadians. It's the biggest military involvement Canada has had since the Korean War. So for some of these countries, the Dutch and the Canadians and a few others have already said they're going to stop fighting in 2010, 2011. Now, it's possible they could change their mind, and Obama is very popular in those countries, and so it's possible that if he makes a public appeal to the populations in those countries, we need your support, this is what we are all trying to achieve, this is our goal that we believe you can sign up to as well, it's possible then that those governments can then go back to their parliaments and get support for continuing involvement in the NATO operation. So while they're publicly saying they're pulling out, it doesn't necessarily mean that they definitely will. Some of them will and some of them won't. So it's really a little bit too early to tell.
I mentioned a couple of times the fact that you were contributed to this report mm-hmm. from the center that looks both at Afghanistan and mm-hmm. Pakistan. And while we're here, our sort of the main focus of our conversation, the idea was to talk about Afghanistan, you really can't separate the two.
Right.
We know that there are al-Qaeda and Taliban that are based in Pakistan and that have then use that base to launch attacks over the border into Afghanistan. And there has been, I think, this long complaint that the United States has had with the government of Pakistan that the government of Pakistan is not doing enough to try to go after these people who are there on the territory of Pakistan. So the question is, well, what now in the future can the United States expect Pakistan to be doing to address this?
Right. That's a great question. It's interesting because everyone does talk about a regional approach. Pakistan and Afghanistan are linked. Of course, they are at very different stages of development, obviously, but they have a very long border. It's a very porous border, and it's easy for these militants to cross back and forth. And we've seen an increase growth in these militia groups on both sides of the border. Now, they take refuge in the Pakistan side of the border because they're taking refuge in places such as the federally administered tribal areas, the Fatah region, which has nominal Pakistani government control there. And so they also have been moving into the Northwest Frontier Province area as well as into parts of Balochistan. These are parts of Pakistan where the central authority hasn't figured out how to extend the writ of the state fully into these places and really to integrate these places much more into the democratic reforms that are going on right now. So it's a question of integrating the Fatah region fully into the constitutional structures as well as dealing with issues such as resource sharing in the Balochistan area. There are a lot of Pakistani issues that haven't been dealt with. And so because of that, some of these places have weak governance. And so the militias have been expanding their influence in all of these regions and really building a whole bunch of different coalitions. Now, it isn't just one big Taliban. There's an Afghan Taliban. There's a Pakistan Taliban. The Pakistan Taliban may be comprised of 40 or so militia groups. They have competing agendas. They don't all want a worldwide caliphate. Some want Pakistan to be an Islamic state. Some just want to control the Fatah region. Some just want the Swat region to be under Islamic law. And so what we need to do is get much smarter about what's happening on the ground. I think we don't have good enough intelligence about what's happening on the ground, and that's why we've been over-dependent on things like drone strikes, which I don't believe are the right response. I think we kill too many civilians with our drone strikes, and over the long term, this may be doing more to recruit two young men to join the Taliban, even than some of these notorious madrasas may be. Mm. So we need to get much smarter about what's happening on the ground in the Pakistan side of the border. We need to work in much more of a partnership arrangement with the Pakistani military, Pakistani frontier constabulary, the frontier corps, the police, the government, not just on the security side, but also, of course, helping to develop these regions because you have very low literacy rates in these areas. They're extremely impoverished. So there are so many challenges in Pakistan alone that you know are completely separate from what's happening in Afghanistan.
Well, just to there's several things there I'd like to go on with, but mm-hmm. Given we're talking about Pakistan, given the difficulty that the government has in addressing the problem in these areas, and we're just talking about logistical and tactical difficulties, and if you combine that with what some people would say is maybe some lack of enthusiasm for doing this, then is it too sour if you ask the question, what can we expect from Pakistan? Is it too sour if you come back with the answer, well, actually not much, that in fact there's only so much we can actually expect that Pakistan will or be able to do to address this problem?
Yeah, that's what many people argue, and many people say there are even some members of the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence, military intelligence directorate, that are involved, that are supporting the Taliban. Mm-hmm. The government, of course, denies it. Mm-hmm. You have a very weak, democratically elected government. It was elected last February after 8 years of military rule. So you have very weak democratic structures. They need to rebuild their whole rule of law system. There are so many challenges that they're facing. So, yes, it is a weak government. It's hard to say, even if there was political will, how much they could do right now, especially because they're facing an enormous financial crisis. They have food shortages, energy shortages. So there are a whole bunch of challenges that they're facing. Now, the U.S. government is actually putting together a pretty interesting package to help deal with some of these development challenges. The Biden-Lugar legislation, it's now called Kerry-Lugar legislation, is trying to get over $1 billion a year, I think 1.2 or something like that, to help with non-military assistance for Pakistan, but putting in a number of conditions that the Pakistani government also needs to complete in order to receive the money. So I think that the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan is changing for the better. I think during the Bush-Musharraf period, it was really about supporting the Pakistani military. We were giving them a lot of money that they weren't necessarily using for counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, but rather to buy weapons in case of a fight with India. So they weren't even putting it or dedicating it to the right areas.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Karen von Hippel. She's the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and also a senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Previously, she was a senior research fellow at the Center for Defense Studies, King's College London. She spent several years working for the UN and the EU in Somalia and Kosovo. She currently serves on the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Fragile States. She's direct experience in over 24 conflict zones. She is one of the contributors to a recently issued report from the Center, and it's titled Afghanistan and Pakistan on the Brink, Framing U.S. Policy Options. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. One of the, I think, within the last, I don't know how long, one of the headlines on Afghanistan is resurgent Taliban. And that you've talked about the fact that you have to be a little bit careful how you use that kind of language when you talk about the Taliban, because there are Pakistani Taliban and there are Afghan Taliban, and then there are Taliban that maybe some people think we could talk to, and maybe then there are some Taliban that some people think aren't interested in talking to us. So I suppose the question is, how do you unpack all of that, and is it possible that there are some, within the vast Taliban umbrella, are there some people that it's actually possible that we could sit down and have some negotiations with?
Right. That's a really great question. And no one has really come up with a good strategy to deal with the Taliban on both sides of the border. I do think that the governments on both sides of the border need to be in the lead. We need to be part of the discussion, though, to make sure that we can support the talks that are ongoing. Now, what I'm a little bit concerned about right now is we are talking about a regional approach, and there are talks with the Taliban on both sides of the border, but we, the U.S. government, are taking a different approach on both sides. So on the Afghan side, I think partially because we're worried that the security is going in the wrong direction, we're considering talks with the Taliban. We've indicated that it may be okay to talk to even somebody like Mullah Omar. Now, if you ask the military, they'll say, well, we don't talk to the Taliban, but we talk to the tribes. That's sort of the official statement, which means, of course, it can happen, but it has to happen in a roundabout way. They thought that that worked in Iraq and that this may be one way to deal with an exit strategy for Afghanistan. So we are indicating that we could be supporting talks on the Afghan side. On the Pakistan side of the border, we've been saying we don't like the talks that are happening in the Swat region, in the Fatah region, in other areas that are being led by the Pakistani government. The Pakistani government in the Northwest Frontier Province, the Awami National Party is a secular political party. They won in the elections. They defeated the Islamic parties over there, and they've been saying, we know these people, let us lead the negotiations. And we haven't been supportive on the Pakistan side. Now, our argument on the Pakistan side has been, well, they're using this time to rearm. They've done that in the past, so they say they want to talk, but these militia groups will just actually rearm and get stronger. I think we need to be more consistent, and if we do want the Pakistani government to lead the negotiations, which I think is the right thing to do, let's help them get the tools that they need to make sure that these guys aren't rearming and make sure that the talks lead to a longer-term peace process, basically. So there are a number of things to deal with. Of course, then there are larger issues like, do you talk to Mullah Omar? I mean, for many Americans, he was part of the September 11th catastrophe. He housed bin Laden. He may have been involved in coming up with a plan. He's been probably keeping the man alive for the last 3 or 4 years. So there are a lot of issues that still haven't been resolved. Who should be considered completely beyond the pale, and who should we talk to? Some of these warlords have done things like throwing acid in little girls' faces. They want a really scary style of very extreme Islamic fundamentalist rule. They don't want girls to go to school. You know, what kinds of what are our limits in the negotiations? And we haven't really had a public discussion about this, and I think we do need to do that in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and also in the United States.
All right. We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. We'll start with someone in Champaign County here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. On this this last line that you dropped in about throwing acid in the face, Hekmatyar was known for doing that before we recruited him to be in the jihad against the nominally the Russians, the whole history there. We shouldn't be posturing about how we're so unable to talk to those sorts of people, since evidence is that when we need them, we use them.
Sure.
So that's not what I called about, though. I attended a talk just recently with Marvin Weinbaum at the local mosque, which was to his credit, but he could not tell me what this surge, and this really does qualify as a surge. This is a percentage of increased, and with the next tranche, as they say, this really is a surge. What are they going to do? What specifically are they going to do on the ground? Now, the RAND Corporation issued a report some time ago that suggested that there is no military solution. Now everybody says, well, it's a combination, but to my mind, there is no military solution, and this is extremely wrongheaded. What one has to do other than that is more difficult, but just putting some more military in is incredibly wrongheaded. One thing that I have to call you on is when you made this remark about, well, Afghans would say, why arm these factions? We just disarmed them. Well, that implies that there was really a widespread disarmament, which isn't true. I mean, this is one warlord, one vote. This is the way we took over and dropped the Taliban out and let the northern lead come in and let the warlords take over is part of the root of the problem. That's why the Taliban are happy. Nobody was really. And the other specific on that is that it isn't something that's just being talked about. That is already being done. The U.S. is already passing out arms. Not that they're hard to get a hold of in Afghanistan, but I guess the better quality ones are. That's already being done, and it's not going to promote any peace. So I'd like to hear some reaction.
Sure, those are all very good points. You're absolutely right. We've been in bed with a lot of nasty people in Afghanistan over the years, especially after 9/11. We saw that as our strategy for winning the war, and of course that created a longer-term problem because we were empowering the warlords, so I totally agree with you there. That was a very big problem, and we need to really think carefully through these things before we start to engage in this type of behavior in the future, because you do create a longer-term problem trying to bring peace and security to a place. It's the same exact problem we've had in Somalia, supporting very unpopular warlords, re-empowering them, whereas, you know, you really want to be working with traditional leaders and people that have much more support amongst the population. So that's a very good point. In terms of the surge, I think actually you hear, I mean, I was just in Afghanistan at the end of September, early October, and I heard from every military leader, American and others, you know, this war can't be won by military means alone. So I do agree we don't need to necessarily go in and get involved in a lot of fighting. On the other hand, what we are doing in Afghanistan now is counterinsurgency, and that's really more about protecting the population than about fighting. And you don't even need to get involved in fighting if you can carry out counterinsurgency in a very successful way. Our troops are much, much better at that than they used to be. So we've come on this extraordinary learning curve since the days when I worked in the Balkans, and you know, even before then, when U.S. military had to go around in looking like RoboCop, they weren't allowed to stay with the local population. They could barely even talk to the local population. Now they sleep with the locals. They do try to provide security. So if we can use these troops in a smart way, then we can protect the population. We can also help the Afghan army and the Afghan police to provide security, because, of course, that's what you need in the long term. We don't want American troops to be there forever. Now, finally, you're talking about arming the local militias, the Arbakai, whatever we call them. I don't think that's happened in an extensive way. I think they've talked about it a lot. I've asked some of my colleagues who are out there in the region. I think there's some of it going on, but it hasn't really started really in a massive way. They're also talking about doing that, by the way, on the Pakistan side of the border. They're called Lashkars on the Pakistan side of the border, and the Pakistani government is talking about doing that. So traditionally, these organized, self-organized militias would only, be armed and fight when the need arises, and then traditionally they would disarm and wait till there was another period of time when they needed to get involved in the fighting. So it's unclear how it would be organized at this stage, and this is of concern to a lot of people. But thanks for your questions.
Well, I just hope our allies don't change their opinion just because Obama's popular. Myself, I don't think they will. Harper is actually in Canada, is talking about not leaving his deadline. And I think this NATO cover for this operation is, and I don't think it's just a it's not just to go after the Taliban. This has to be seen as part of the great powers, the great game. And, you know, Afghanistan actually has a short border with China, and that's actually when people talk about bringing the powers in the area. They don't often talk about China, though I think it would be important to include them. And, people think this is mad, which you can actually find the NATO chief, von Schieffer, or I forget his name now, his address to the CFR some time ago, where he specifically said, you know, this is because this region is strategic. It isn't at all just because we're worried about a so-called GWAT or whatever the latest moniker for the so-called war on terrorism is. Thanks. I don't expect you to agree, but...
All right. Well, unless you want to comment, I have another caller we can go to.
Sure. No, just one quick point about the neighbors. I mean, it is true. China, Russia, India, of course, Iran, they all need to be part of a longer-term solution. They can all be spoilers, and we really need to be much more clever about how we bring them in to help us out. So thank you for that.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Champaign here, line number two. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I've read somewhere that in Afghanistan, if anybody invades the country and stays there longer than 5 years, then the population in general has a tendency to see them as invaders and occupiers, and the possibility of, like, cooperation with them then is pretty much precluded.
Mm-hmm.
How I don't see you going down this road, but what if we faced a military catastrophe? What if we endured a military catastrophe? Or don't you think we could endure a military catastrophe in Afghanistan? What do you think chances are?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, we've been there more than 5 years now, so we've been there since
right.
early 2002. I think we're actually not unpopular. I think the Afghans, of course, get very upset when we kill civilians, so the issue of civilian casualties is a problem, and I think our military is trying to be more careful about that. But I think that they still want us to stay because they're very worried about a Taliban takeover of the country. But yeah, generally, no one wants their country occupied by a foreign power. I mean, we would feel the same way if America were occupied by a foreign power. You give the foreigners some sort of window if you think that they're going to help you out. Sometimes it's only 6 months to a year. We saw what happened in Iraq, that when we were not able to protect the population, they turned against us very quickly. So that is, of course, very important.
You didn't address the part of my question relates to a military catastrophe.
Oh, right. Good point. Sorry, I forgot. Yeah, that is an issue, and I did talk to people about that when I was out there. Of course, if we lost a lot of American soldiers or if some of our allies took much more significant losses than they're taking now, how would the American psyche deal with that? And it's not clear, actually, that we would have the staying power. I think many people are no longer convinced that Afghanistan, you know, is a long-term threat for al-Qaeda or whatever. It's possible al-Qaeda could return there, but of course al-Qaeda can now go to many parts of the world. It's a very diffuse, networked organization, and it's able to inspire many groups in many parts of the world that it may not even have any formal interaction with. So they may not use these territories in the same way in the future. And so there are certainly many people who are wondering, why do we need to make this long-term commitment? Why do we need to lose treasure and personnel for this issue? And this really does need to be, I think it's good to have talk shows like this, because I do think we need much more of a public discussion about the value of staying in a place like Afghanistan.
Specifically, though, do you see any chance that the Taliban, I don't see al-Qaeda, but that the Taliban might be able to successfully create a military situation where, like Khaesan, analogously, where they destroy, like, say, 1,000 or 2,000 of our people?
No, I don't think they can do that. I don't think they have the capacity to do that. Really, most of the deaths that are happening right now are happening through IED attacks. They're not actually happening through fighting or through combat. We are losing some people in combat. Most of the soldiers are being lost through IED attacks, and that means that they aren't capable of launching a larger scale attack. Now, it doesn't mean they might not get some, you know, I don't know, anything can happen. I mean, I can't say that won't happen. Anything is possible in war situations. But at the moment, I don't think that that will be a threat. And, of course, we are sort of dispersed all over the place. We're not, I mean, there are certainly bases that have a lot of people on them, but we're really spread out all over the country right now.
So you don't think Kabul, for instance, could fall, possibly?
It's quite scary right now in Kabul. It's very dangerous. It's very insecure. You can't walk around. If you're an aid worker, people have been kidnapped. They've been killed. They have barriers all over the streets there. I mean, anything can happen in a war. It's really hard to say. But I do think that I don't think we're losing. I don't think they're winning. I think we're in a stalemate situation. And I think that now that we are much more seized of it, we really dropped the ball for a while because we're focused so much more on Iraq, that I do think we will be able to push them back. But, you know, but it's going to be a really tough fight.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Karen Von Hippel. She's the she's the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project and senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just before we, I'll take some other callers, but I do want to ask you about the level of support now, what you might be able to say about the level of support in Washington for Hamid Karzai. And apparently there are some people within the Obama administration who are not happy with Mr. Karzai and the job that he has done, and maybe more generally the job that the Afghan government has done. And there, I guess, are some people asking this question, well, will the United States continue to support him? Would they even do something to try to nudge, or maybe you'd want to put a stronger, use a stronger word, to get him out of the presidency and he see him replaced by somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a very good question. I think he's been in power for some time now. I think the best thing for Afghan democracy would be for him to not run in the next elections. Now, he, of course, has said he wants to run. He's trying to push the polls forward to April. They're supposed to be held in August so that which will give soldiers and others time to not only deal with the registration in insecure areas, but also to provide security during the elections. He's trying to push it forward because I think he's worried that about the additional time may make it easier for others to try to push him out. I think, he's been in power for a long time. I think he's tired. I think he should go. Now, he wants to stay, but I don't think we should totally give up on him either, actually. I do think that we can work with him, and we've seen some positive signs with Holbrooke's trip, and I think he and Karzai had some good meetings. I think Holbrooke and others in the U.S. government agreed that the Afghans can participate in our review, and the Pakistanis, of course, are also going to participate in the review, which is it's a positive sign. So I do think it's possible to build up a much stronger and better working relationship with him that really is more about a partnership. I don't think, while he and Bush got along very well and had weekly conference calls and all that, I don't think that the Bush administration was really pushing him enough to try to deal with corruption in his government, to try to extend the government to insecure areas, to try to provide services, et cetera, all those things that he hasn't been able to do. So I don't think he is personally a corrupt dictator or anything like that. It's just that he's been in power for too long. He's really retrenched, and either he needs to be galvanized into action again or he should step down, but I don't think he'll step down. So,
all right. Next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You mentioned earlier that you thought that the U.S. troops were still popular in Afghanistan, except for the civilian casualties. And that, to me, kind of begs the question because there is no, obviously the track record indicates, there is no U.S. occupation of Afghanistan without civilian casualties. In fact, and every anticipation is that as U.S. troops increase, more Afghan civilians will be killed. So the U.S. occupation without civilian casualties isn't an item on the menu. And in addition, there was a piece in the Christian Science Monitor yesterday that pointed out that in the areas of the country where more U.S. troops are expected, the increase in troops is wildly unpopular in the Pashtun areas of the South. And that seems like maybe that's the more relevant data point. The people who are going to see the U.S. troops in their areas, how do they feel? According to the Christian Science Monitor, they're totally opposed. So I wonder what your reaction to those two questions.
Yeah, so complicated, isn't it? I mean, it's true that if you increase the troops, you're going to increase the fighting, and that probably will mean more civilian casualties. It doesn't necessarily have to mean that, though. We can be much more careful. We can not be as reliant on airstrikes if we are smarter with our fighting on the ground and the way we engage with the Taliban. And if we can protect the people in the South. I think part of the reason that U.S. troops aren't always that popular in some of the Pashtun areas is that we haven't been able to provide security for them. The Taliban aren't popular either. So it's not as if, we're fighting hearts and minds, we're fighting for hearts and minds in an area that's really already been won over by the insurgency. That hasn't happened. It's just that they are afraid that that we are going to leave. Now, the Taliban, the sort of cliche Taliban quote is, you foreigners have all the clocks, but we have all the time. In other words, you're going to leave, and we will be here for the long term. And so they threaten the locals who cooperate with international troops. They've killed people. They've burnt down schools. They've done a lot of horrible things for people who are just really trying to provide basic development and basic services for their own population. So if we can get into those areas and provide enough security so that the locals can rebuild their life and the military and the police can reestablish security, then I think in the long term that is, you know, then we will be more popular, of course. But you know, it's 17,000 troops isn't enough to make that happen all over the place. And so the question is, do we just concentrate on two or three of the very insecure areas with these troops? You know, really we need to come up with a strategy. Maybe we focus on one or two areas and then move troops further. Can we convince some of our European and Canadian partners to help us in a more significant way on the counterinsurgency side? You know, how much more can we push the Afghan police and the military to deal with this type, with these very insecure areas? So those are issues that we still need to work out.
Well, I think the caller certainly raises a good point. According to one of the stories that I read, the number of civilian casualties last year was the most since the United States went in. And you have to wonder, is there any way to keep that from just continuing to nudge up every year? And overall, what does that do for Afghan support of the American presence?
Right. I mean, I think there are ways of reducing civilian casualties, and I think we've done it in other places. So we do have to be much more careful in the way that we fight and the way that we engage. And, of course, I think also if we get more involved in negotiating with various Taliban, I think, you know, people talk about moderate Taliban. I don't really know what that means. But there are certainly Taliban who would be willing to support the Afghan government if the right incentives are on offer. And so whether that means that we pay them, that they get more of a say in local governance in the area, there are certainly people who could be peeled off. There will be some hardcore people that can't be peeled off. But if we can get much better at that side of the picture, if we can get better at our counterinsurgency, which doesn't require fighting as much, and we are less reliant on these airstrikes and drones, then we can provide better protection for the people. And I do think that the military is very aware of that right now. And they're very...
One more caller we'll try to get in, and that's Champagne. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, Afghanistan certainly has its history of conflict, and Russia was in a much better position geographically than we were or we are, and wasn't successful. And even Alexander the Great, who was an extremely successful conqueror, wasn't able to take Afghanistan. And I wonder why we're naive enough to believe that we'll come to a resolution that's successful in our eyes when nobody else has been able to do so in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that a lot, and, you know, I'm not so sure I buy into these arguments. I mean, don't forget, remember when we went into Iraq, everyone said, oh, the Brits were never able to, you know, rebuild Iraq, and everyone left Iraq. Well, we actually managed to get it together eventually in Iraq. Of course, it took a very long time, and there was essentially ethnic cleansing and forced population movements, and we paid off the insurgency and all these other issues. But, I mean, I don't think we should just throw up our hands because the Russians and Alexander the Great weren't able to do this a long time ago. I don't think, at the same time, I also don't think we need to be this colonial power in the country either. So what we really want to do is facilitate and help Afghans reestablish security, reestablish government, and then draw down significantly on the security side and really just focus much more on the development and economic support side. So I don't see us being there, you know, with troops for the next 20 years in large numbers at all, actually. And I think once we start to reduce the troop numbers significantly, we can spend a lot less money on economic development, which is far more important over the long term.
Well, we're down to the point. We have maybe about 2 minutes, and you've just touched on the point that I was going to ask as a way of finishing up. Now, the president has talked about, now he set a date for withdrawal of combat troops mm-hmm. from Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have every reason to expect, though, that significant numbers of troops of American soldiers will still be there, and who knows how long. So now in Afghanistan, I'm sure that there are some people who would wonder, well, even when we get to the end of significant combat operations, whenever that is, how long that we should expect troops, some significant presence there. Now, have you said something like, well, they're not going to be there for 20 years, but does that mean that we could have significant numbers of soldiers there for another 10 years, 15 years?
I actually think that the Obama administration is really thinking of drawing down in a significant way by the time of the next election. So I think that the timeline is they're hoping the timeline will be shorter. They don't want to get into another Vietnam situation. I think they're very focused on it. And I do think that despite all the problems that we have in all these conflict zones, not just Afghanistan or Pakistan, but all over the world, we have problems in these places. We're not as good at this work as we should be. I do think that once we get fully focused on it, we get the right people on it, we have good leadership, that we can actually really make things happen.
And do you think that that Mr. Holbrook was a good choice now for a special envoy to the region?
I do think he was a good choice. You know, one of the big problems we have, if you go to Afghanistan today, you have this crazy mess of international partners all doing too many different things. They're not coordinated as they should be. Some are working through the Afghan government. Some aren't. It's a real disorganized mess that's been allowed to fester over the years. And you do need a very strong personality to try to reestablish order just on the international side. Of course, on the U.S. military side and the NATO side, we also need to organize things better. And that won't necessarily be up to him, but I think that that the U.S. military is also really trying to focus on ways to improve operations there. And then, of course, we need to really work with the Afghan government, with the Pakistani governments, with these two governments to really make sure that they implement the reforms, because over the long term, these places are far too complex for this type of work to be outsourced to us. They really need to be led by the local actors. They know their country better than we do, and they know how to fix things, and there are things that do work there. So we need to really find the things that work, such as the National Solidarity Program in Afghanistan. It's a very good development program that is really being led by Afghans and monitored by Afghans. We need to work with those positive examples and really support them in more significant ways than we've been doing so far.
Well, there we will have to stop. Our guest, Karen Von Hippel, is a senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She's one of the contributors to the report Afghanistan and Pakistan on the Brink that was put out by the Center in February 2009. If you're interested in taking a look at it, you can go to their website, csis.org. And Ms. Von Hippel, thanks very much.
Thank you.